as civil aviation workers, but unfortunately it comes as Yemen's airports are closed and being targeted in Saudi-led air raids. Sana'a Airport especially is being bombed in an unjustified way. The justifications made by the Saudi-led coalition that Sana'a Airport is being used for military purposes are incorrect. The United Nations is aware of the airport's activity and has daily flights through Sana'a Airport.
Protesters demanded the reopening of Sana'a Airport and called on the international community to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift its siege on Yemen. They held the UN responsible for not taking any action against Saudi violations.
Over 100,000 patients with chronic diseases have died due to the continued closure of Sana'a Airport, and there are about 400,000 more who are suffering from the shutdown. There are also 1 million patients who suffer from a lack of medicine that need refrigeration and must arrive through Sana'a Airport. The humanitarian situation is tragic and reflects the scale of the tragedy that Yemenis are experiencing due to the ongoing Saudi blockade.
6 years ago, Saudi Arabia imposed restrictions on Yemen's airspace and shut down Sana'a Airport. The closure has led to the death of tens of thousands of patients, including children, who needed to travel abroad for treatment unavailable in Yemen due to the collapse of the healthcare system. Thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, have died while waiting for a chance to travel through this closed airport, which is only receiving the United Nations flights. People here say the airport should also be closed to the UN to push the world body to take real measures against the Saudi blockade imposed on Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Russian leadership is extremely concerned about the possibility of large-scale hostilities in the eastern Ukraine, Donbass and Crimea. There has not been such a level of military threat throughout Russia's modern history. NATO has dismissed Russia's proposal on zones of influence to somehow stabilize the situation. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has rejected a diplomatic dialogue, giving Ukraine carte blanche to withdraw from the Minsk agreements. The situation is more than ever close to a war. The United States has removed all diplomatic and political restrictions, while Ukraine's accession to the North Atlantic Alliance is a red line for Russia.
We are witnessing the expansionism of NATO led by the United States in the territories near Russian borders. That's why President Vladimir Putin is seeking legally binding security guarantees to prevent further destruction of the security system. If that does not work, our retaliatory measures will be harsh and the West will regret the missed opportunity for a deal with Russia.
Things appear to be heading toward a scenario of Russia's complete international isolation, in all-out technology and trade blockade, and an embargo on the purchase of oil and gas. To begin this plan, a military scenario might be implemented in Ukraine.
The NATO leadership understands that they have become weak and there is no unity in sight. They need threats to maintain funding, and they create them by portraying Russia as an aggressor. That's why we do not hear a single word of condemnation from the West against Ukraine's escalation of violence in the East.
The Kremlin understands that passivity only makes things worse. The responsibility for the conflict will remain with Russia, and no one will be interested in the real picture.
It is unpleasant to negotiate with NATO and the US, and talks with Ukraine will not resolve anything because it is completely subordinate to Washington. Russia needs to remember one thing: the Anglo-Saxon respect only force. Russia must continue to strengthen its security and combat capabilities given the unacceptable policies of NATO and the US.
Russia demands legal guarantees since the West has not kept its promise that after the reunification of Germany, NATO would not expand eastward. Further advancement of Western forces and provocations will affect the fundamental security interests of Russia.
If Moscow's legitimate concerns about Ukraine and NATO are not taken into account, Russia will take retaliatory measures to correct the military strategic balance. An alternative to this could be long-term security guarantees on its western borders. Marina Katunova, Moscow.
The coronavirus continues to provoke sharply different responses across Europe. There has been much concern over the new Omicron variant, but markets are surging on the bet that worries about Omicron have been as overblown as they were for the Delta variant. France has had perhaps the strictest coronavirus measures in the West, but the government surprisingly announced only a handful of new minor measures and no new lockdown. Corporate profits and economic inequality continue to surge unabated during the corona era, and incumbent politicians may be thinking about this spring's election.
French businesses are accumulating a lot of debt because business conditions are far from optimal. We're going to see a lot of bankruptcies all down the line because sales are not rising, even though costs are. We need a long-term logic, which is much more efficient, and even if we decide on even stricter sanitation controls.
The government also said schools will not be closed early for vacation, and they rejected a vaccination order for children, at least for now. France may have been swayed by a new report which found that during the first 15 months of the epidemic, not one healthy child between the ages of 5 to 18 died of COVID in Germany, Europe's largest country.
France's vaccination rate is now almost 80%. Prior to the pandemic, France was considered the most vaccine-skeptical nation in the world, but the introduction of a corona pass, which almost totally isolates the unvaccinated, has forced people into compliance.
Around Europe, lockdowns are back in Austria, despite massive protests. Germany is debating a vaccine mandate. Italy has moved to a new super health pass. And even though two-thirds of Europe is fully vaccinated, stricter measures may soon be arriving, regardless of the impact of Omicron. Perhaps the only certainty is that no government seems able to please all their citizens.
France's government has had a very poor strategy. For example, we provided free corona tests for a long time. But it was a major error because it cost us 6 billion euros. This money could have been used to create an actual screening strategy which could have slowed the progression of the virus.
After 21 months of corona domination, what remains most unknown is when things will go back to normal. Europeans, especially non-vaccinated ones, are increasingly saying that time may be never. Rami Mazahari, Paris.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. limelight.
International Monetary Fund has warned the emergency support provided by central banks and finance ministries during the COVID-19 pandemic has fueled speculation and left the world vulnerable to another financial crisis. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Patricia Cohen and Alan Rappaport. The piece is titled, World's Growth Cools and the Rich-Poor Divide Widens. The article has been published by the New York Times. A closely watched report warned on Tuesday, 12th of October, as the world economy struggles to find its footing, the resurgence of the coronavirus and supply chain chokeholds threaten to hold back the global economic recovery's momentum. The International Monetary Fund said in its latest World Economic Outlook report, the overall growth rate will remain near 6% this year, a historically high level after a recession. But the expansion reflects a vast divergence in the fortunes of rich and poor countries. Worldwide poverty, hunger, and unmanageable debt are all under upswing. Employment has fallen, especially for women, reversing many of the gains they made in recent years. Uneven access to vaccines and healthcare is at the heart of the economic disparities. While booster vaccine shots are becoming available in some wealthier nations, a staggering 96% of people in low-income countries are still unvaccinated. Geeta Gopinath, the IMF's chief economist, wrote in the report, "Recent developments have made it abundantly clear that we're all in this together, and the pandemic is not over anywhere until it is over everywhere." The outlook for the United States, Europe, and other advanced economies has also darkened. Factories hobbled by pandemic-related restrictions and bottlenecks at key ports around the world have caused crippling supply shortages. A lack of workers in many industries is contributing to the clogs. The U.S. Labor Department reported on Tuesday, 12th of October, that a record 4.3 million workers quit their jobs in the month of August to take or seek new jobs or to leave the workforce altogether. In the United States, weakening consumption and large declines in inventory caused the International Monetary Fund to pare back its growth projections to 6% from earlier 7% estimates in July. In Germany, manufacturing output has taken a hit because key commodities are hard to find, and lockdown measures over the summer have dampened growth in Japan. Fear of rising inflation, even if likely to be temporary, is growing. Prices are climbing for food, medicines, and oil, as well as for cars and trucks. Inflation worries could also limit government's ability to stimulate the economy if a slowdown worsens. As it is, the unusual infusion of public support in the United States and Europe is winding down. Geeta Gopinath, the International Monetary Fund's chief economist, said, "Overall risks for economic prospects have increased, and policy trade-offs have become more complex." The IMF lowered its 2021 global economic growth forecast to 5.9%, down from 6% projected in July. For 2022, the estimate is 4.9%. Gregory Dacko, chief U.S. economist at Oxford Economics, said, "The key to understanding the global economy is that recoveries in different countries are out of sync." He said each and every economy is suffering or benefiting from its own idiosyncratic factors. Gregory Dacko said for countries like China, Vietnam, and South Korea, whose economies have large manufacturing sectors, inflation hits them where it hurts the most, raising costs of raw materials that reverberate through the protection process. The pandemic has underscored how economic success or failure in one country can ripple throughout the world. Floods in Shaanxi, China's mining region, and monsoons in India's coal-producing states contribute to rising energy prices worldwide. A COVID outbreak in Ho Chi Minh City that shuts factories means shop owners in Hoboken won't have shoes and sweaters to sell. National Monetary Fund warned that if the coronavirus or its variants continue to hopscotch across the globe, it could reduce the world's estimated output by as much as $5.3 trillion over the next 5 years. The worldwide surge in energy prices threatens to impose more hardship as it hampers the economic recovery. Recently, oil prices hit a 7-year high in the United States. With winter approaching, Europeans are worried that heating costs will soar when temperatures drop. In other spots, the shortages have cut even deeper, causing blackouts in some places that paralyze transport, closing down factories and threatening food supplies. In some Southeast Asian countries, electricity is being rationed in many provinces, and many companies are operating at less than half of their capacity, contributing to an already significant slowdown in economic growth. India's coal reserves have dropped to dangerously low levels. And over the weekend, Lebanon's 6 million residents were left without any electricity for more than 24 hours after fuel shortages shut down the nation's power plants. The power outage is just the latest in a series of disasters created by the United States and its Western allies there. Its economic and financial crisis has been one of the world's worst in the past 150 years. Oil producers in West Asia and elsewhere are lately benefiting from the jump in oil prices, but many nations in the region and North Africa are still trying to resuscitate their pandemic-battered economies. According to newly updated reports from the World Bank, 13 of the 16 countries in that region will have lower standards of living this year than they did before the pandemic, in large part because of the underfinanced, imbalanced and ill-prepared healthcare systems. Other countries were so overburdened by debt even before the pandemic that governments were forced to limit spending on healthcare to repay foreign lenders. In Latin America and the Caribbean, there are fears of a second lost decade of growth like the one experienced after 2010. In South Africa, over one-third of the population is out of work. And in East Asia and the Pacific, a World Bank update warned that COVID-19 threatens to create a combination of slow economic growth and increasing inequality for the first time this century. Businesses in Indonesia, Mongolia, and the Philippines lost on average 40% or more of their typical monthly sales. In Thailand and in many Pacific Island economies are expected to have less output in 2023 than they did before the coronavirus pandemic. Overall, though, some developing economies are doing better than last year, partly because of the increase in prices of commodities like oil and metals that they produce. Economic growth projections ticked up slightly to 6.4% in 2021 compared to 6.3% estimated in July. Carl Tannenbaum, chief economist at Northern Trust, said, "The recovery has been incredibly uneven, and that's a problem for everyone. Developing countries are essential to global economic function. The outlook is clouded by uncertainty. The International Monetary Fund warned erratic policy decisions, like U.S. Congress's delay in lifting the debt ceiling, can further set back the economic recovery. But the biggest risk is the emergence of a more infectious and deadlier coronavirus variant." Ms. Geeta Gopinath, the International Monetary Fund's chief economist, urged vaccine manufacturers to support the expansion of vaccine production in developing countries. Earlier this year, the IMF approved $650 billion worth of emergency currency reserves that has been distributed to countries around the world. In this latest report, it again called on wealthy countries to help ensure that these funds are used to benefit poor countries that have been struggling the most with the fallout from the coronavirus. David Malpass, the president of the World Bank, said, "We're witnessing what I call tragic reversals in development across many dimensions." He added, "Progress in reducing extreme poverty has been set back for years. For some countries, it has been set back by a decade or even more."
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. People in the besieged Gaza Strip mark the 34th anniversary of the establishment of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. Thousands of Palestinians joined a rally in Gaza City to commemorate the occasion and voice their support for the resistance movement. Addressing the rally, senior Hamas officials condemned Israel's continued aggression against Palestinians, pledging that Hamas will continue resistance against the regime until all occupied Palestinian territories are liberated. The resistance group also denounced as an act of treason the normalization of ties between Israel and some Arab states, founded in 1987, which coincides with the first Palestinian intifada or uprising. Hamas is the largest Palestinian resistance movement. Since its inception, Hamas has defended the impoverished enclave against four major Israeli wars, including the most recent 11-day conflict that ended in an Egyptian-brokered ceasefire back in May. We're now joined by our correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, who's with us from Gaza City, to tell us more about commemorations. Ashraf?
Yes, Badia. Following the Friday prayers today, thousands of people gathered at two different locations, one in Gaza City and one in northern Gaza, during the protest in Gaza with the commemoration rally, senior Hamas official Mahmoud al-Zahar praised the resistance and also condemned the normalization between Arab regimes, especially in the Persian Gulf, and the Israeli regime. He also called normalization high treason and stabbed in the back against the Palestinian people by those Arabs who normalized ties with Tel Aviv. He also talked about the fact that the theme of this year's Hamas anniversary was Dar al-Quds, or the shield of al-Quds, and he also talked about the Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails, as well as the importance of lifting the unjust Israeli blockade against the Gaza Strip. Hamas was founded in 1987, coinciding with the first Palestinian intifada or popular uprising. Hamas has been garnering support throughout the years due to the fact that it refuses to recognize the Israeli regime and also its adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli regime, as well as the fierce battles it waged against the Israeli regime, especially the recent one. During May, when Hamas's military wing, the Azim Qassam Brigades, fired rockets towards the Israeli regime because Israel was desecrating the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and also was trying to evict Palestinians in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Al-Quds.
Thanks a lot, Ashraf. Press TV's Ashraf Shannon joining us from Gaza City. Well, joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have from the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier, joining us from Edinburgh. And also journalist and political analyst Hafsa Kara Mustafa joining us from the British capital, London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start off with Mr. Napier in Edinburgh. It's great to have you with us. Sir, Hamas, as we know, was established in 1987, coinciding with the First Intifada. Why was Hamas created?
Because the Israelis have a project to dispossess the entire Palestinian people. And from the very beginning of the Zionist movement, they have made no secret of that. Every truce, every ceasefire is only a stop on the road to Zionists controlling as much as possible of Palestine, with as few Palestinians being allowed to remain as possible. The Zionists achieve this through periodic massacres, but also between those massacres, there's dispossession, there's expulsion, destruction of homes, bureaucratic means. All of which means that the Palestinians, if they do not resist, simply face a doom at the hands of the Zionists. Because the Zionists want all of Palestine and the Palestinians must be removed. So Hamas filled a vacuum with the appetite among Palestinians to resist, and the fact that that was not being met by the elements of the Palestine Liberation Organization. So Hamas is a major part of Palestinian society. It's not the only part, but it's a major part of Palestinian society. It won elections in Gaza and in the West Bank by a landslide the last time that elections were allowed, even under occupation. The vote from the Palestinian people was overwhelmingly for Hamas. And the response from the West was, of course, to punish the Palestinians for voting in a way that was not authorized by Washington or London or Tel Aviv. And since then, we've seen an increasingly brutal siege of Gaza and house demolitions and Jewish-only settlements spreading across the face of the West Bank. So resistance is something which Palestinians understand they have no alternative but to get involved in.
Right.
And although things look bleak with Israel reaching out to the Gulf princedoms and Emirates and to Morocco and to Egypt and so on, Palestinians will have no choice but to resist. Because unlike, say, a colonial situation in Kenya or India or somewhere else, where Britain can hope to hand over and have a sort of neo-colonial arrangement, when they see defeat facing them, they can retreat. The Palestinian Authority is being given nothing by Israel because Israel actually wants everything and is not prepared to concede anything to the Palestinian people.
Sure.
So resistance is the only option.
Sure. Let's bring in Ms. Mustafa from London. Ms. Mustafa, where does Hamas stand in the equation of resistance against the Israeli occupation?
Well, at the moment, it's probably one of the only major resistance movement, given that the Fatah has almost capitulated completely politically to Israel and is now almost a security apparatus wing of the Israeli occupation. So Hamas is vital to the resistance movement and to also the safety and the ongoing revival of the Palestinian cause, because of course no one is actually resisting Israel anymore. Bit by bit and government by government in the region are actually normalizing with Israel one way or another, in a sort of subdued way or in a very official normal capacity, as we've seen with the Gulf monarchies and Morocco recently. And so Hamas is almost the bulwark against the Israeli expansion, and it's an essential element of the Palestinian resistance and Palestinian identity. And I think at all levels it needs to be supported, given that it is presenting this barrier against Zionist expansion and Israeli occupation of Palestinian land and deletion of Palestinian identity and history.
Mr. Napier, how would you describe some of the resistance group's major achievements so far?
To survive? In any anti-colonial struggle, colonial power, Britain, America, Belgium, Spain, France, and Israel, has overwhelming technological edge. And that's certainly the case since Israel was founded in 48 up until today. But against those overwhelming odds, the fact is the Palestinian resistance, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and other groups have survived. And the confrontation during May was not a victory for Israel. 2006 in Lebanon was not a victory for Israel. And even the overwhelming power that Israel has, they have not been able to crush the Palestinians. And in the past, although they pay a terrible cost, thousands dead, thousands massacred, nonetheless, after each one of these confrontations, Israel does not go away with a victory. Because the only victory which they can feel secure with is a Palestinian capitulation, is for the Palestinians to agree that their dispossession in 48 and again in 67 was legitimate, but they don't. So although Israel gets validation from Washington and the EU, London and Rabat and Abu Dhabi, that doesn't add up to the recognition that they seek, which is for Palestinians to concede defeat. And although the Oslo Agreement was a major defeat for the Palestinians, and for reasons that it would be another meeting, another discussion, Yasser Arafat conceded 78% of Palestine to Zionist control. That has since been seen to be a tragic defeat. But Palestinians continue to resist, and that resistance really inspires people around the world, because never in the history of anti-colonial struggle, Vietnam, Algeria, Aden, and so on, has the equation been so overwhelming in support of the colonial power, and technologically, it's the weaker side, the Palestinians here, who still manage to endure, not just in Gaza, but through other means of resistance in the West Bank as well. They're not broken, and until they're broken, Israel can never be secure.
Ms. Mustafa, looking at the wars that Hamas and the Gaza Strip has been through, the asymmetrical wars, the deadly attacks by the Israeli regime, the blockade of Gaza, the silence and complacency of the UN, still Hamas has actually managed to become stronger over the years in comparison to its earlier days. What would you attribute that to?
Well, I think it's the realization that there is no negotiation possible with the terrorist entity that is Israel. I mean, time and time again, we've seen that those parties who concede anything to Israel actually come out of it losing. And therefore, Hamas has actually realized that engaging in any way with an entity that relies on deceit, on lies, on war crimes, on the unconditional support of corrupt regimes that provided with arms and are very unbalanced in their judgment of the Palestinian cause, that really leads nowhere. And I think, to paraphrase also the leader of the Islamic Republic, I think these are governments, Western governments in Israel, cannot be trusted. And time again, we've seen that whenever there was any decision or step made towards any form of agreement with Israel or with Western governments. These fail constantly because these are governments that are deceitful, they're not to be trusted, and they also regard the life of black and brown people essentially as disposable. We've seen this, that Palestinians, we are being lectured around the world about human causes, about various issues that are supposed to be about the sanctity of life, but actually we're seeing Palestinians killed on a daily basis, and it's barely making a blip on Western media radars, clearly indicating that the value of life of Middle Easterners, for instance, has no value. And I think Hamas has actually picked up on this and realized that engaging in any way with corrupt governments such as Israel and Western governments has absolutely no future. And their focus now is in respecting the cause of their people, their defense, their liberation movement, and remain steadfast in that practice and that policy of actually continuing to survive and continuing to resist Israeli occupation until, of course, victory. And victory, it will come. It seems very difficult at this stage to envisage how the very weaker Palestinian side can overcome the far more well-armed Israeli side. But again, I mean, if we look at the colonial past that was mentioned by the other panelists, we'll know that actually, time and time again, the weaker part, when they continue to struggle, and however long it takes, will eventually come out of it victorious.
Mick Napier, the recent blacklisting and designations against Hamas by the UK, by the EU, by the US, when we look at that, are Western allies of Israel trying to weaken the resistance at the behest of the Israelis and to the benefit of Tel Aviv?
Yes, it's certainly at the behest of Tel Aviv, but they're very enthusiastic in doing it anyway. And I guess if you're looking for some good news, the attempts domestically in Britain and in the USA and France and Germany to silence pro-Palestinian voices comes from the fact that popular opinion in all these countries, I include Germany, where public voices in support of Palestine are extremely difficult, where repression is very serious, but nonetheless, public opinion, when you measure it, is hostile to Israel. In fact, so hostile that in the past the EU has apologized to the State of Israel for European public opinion and promised the State of Israel that this public opinion would not be allowed to influence EU policies. Look, I'm speaking to you from Britain. Britain gave birth to the whole dark shadow of Zionism over the Middle East. Britain has protected the state. Britain protected the Zionist colonizing project when it was so weak that Palestinians could have driven them into the sea. But behind British imperial power, the Zionist project grew from being extremely weak to being strong enough to throw off the British patronage and to defeat the Palestinians on their own or with American and French support. So Britain has been the father of the crime from the very beginning. And its complicity with Israel is not only military, it's economic, political, diplomatic, and so on. British aircraft were recently, and so were Greek and other aircraft, flying in a joint exercise with Israel about 3 or 4 weeks ago, even while the Israeli aircraft were bombing Gaza. So this complicity is deep and long-standing, and it's very strategic, because during the negotiations with Iran on the nuclear pact, it's quite open in the British press that it will be reported that Israel is getting ready to attack Iran if Iran doesn't reach a deal with the Western powers, Russia and China. So Israel is an attack dog of last resort. It failed in Lebanon in 2006 for sure, but it succeeded in 56 for a period of time, and it succeeded in 67 in enforcing Western rule upon the people of the Middle East. Whether it can do that again in the future is another matter. But that's why the West backed Israel up to the hilt. But the good news is that the repression of pro-Palestinian voices in Britain and other countries is very much because Israel is already, because of Palestinian resistance, and right. I don't think we can say this often enough, because of Palestinian resistance, Israel has already lost the fight for world public opinion. And that's that is a very significant victory.
Ms. Mustafa, is Israel fearful of Hamas? And not just Hamas, but of Palestinian resistance and of Palestinian unity altogether?
Of course, and I think the best thing for Palestinian future would be to see unity between the West Bank and Gaza through a political decision between Hamas and Fatah. Any disunity serves Israel in the short term and in the long term. But I think irrespective of that decision, I think the fact that Hamas is still there, there's still a force to be reckoned with, is a problem for Israel and shows, obviously, and reveals to Israel that they haven't won despite their military might and their military superiority and their very, very powerful friends. So I think, in essence, although it seems almost simplistic to say, but I think just the survival of the Palestinian people and just the survival of Hamas as a political organization and a resistance movement is in itself a victory for the Palestinian cause, because it's simply indicates to Israel that they will never be safe, they will never be rest in peace in a land that isn't their own, because there will always be resistance to their illegal occupation and their illegal entity that was established illegally on somebody else's land. So I think, again, just to reiterate the point, I think the mere fact that Hamas survives and remains a force to be reckoned with is in itself a victory for the Palestinian cause.
I'm going to stay with you, Ms. Mustafa, for one last question before we go back to Mr. Napier. What are some of the future goals that Hamas should pursue, in your opinion?
To reiterate, I would say that it would be to engage in some sort of political unity decision with Fatah, because I think any disunity will obviously weaken it, and I think it's also to become more organized. I think it's also to engage with more friendly governments around the region and not be tugged in any sectarian or political decision that is outside and would not benefit the Palestinian cause. I think they need to just engage with governments that are friendly and supportive of their cause, irrespective of whether different governments do not necessarily get on with each other, but as long as they are united in their position in regards to Palestine, then Hamas needs to engage with them and needs to recognize essentially who its friends are and who its foes are. And I think that needs a bit more political clarity from some of the leadership, which I think they have, and I think many lessons have been learned, in particular in the aftermath of the Arab Spring.
Mr. Napier, a final thoughts from you as we wrap up the program. What are some of the future goals, in your opinion, that Hamas should pursue?
Our colleague's right. Unity is essential. Palestinians demand it. Palestinian prisoners demand it and work towards it across all factions. But the side which wins in an anti-colonial struggle, the Algerians, the Vietnamese and others, were far and away the weaker side. They suffer terrible casualties. But the people who win are not the ones who can kill the most. If that was true, the Israelis would win. They are the killers. The side which wins is the popular side that can take the punishment and endure and continue to demand their rights and their freedom. And that looks as if it's going to be the Palestinians.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Allow me to thank my guest, Mr. McNapier from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, joining us from Edinburgh. And thanks to journalist and political analyst Hafsa Kara Mustafa, speaking to us from the British capital, London. And also thanks to you for staying with us on this edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the
limelight.
The reality is that the U.S. military campaign in Syria, from arming the very armed groups it is ostensibly at war with, to its massive undercounting and denial of civilian casualties, has been a dismal display of illegality and failure, says Kate Kaiser Ryder in an article published under the heading, "The U.S. military can't be trusted to investigate civilian casualties." Stay tuned for more. The U.S. Central Command has reported recently a U.S. drone strike in Idlib, Syria, against a senior member of al-Qaeda. The U.S. Central Command reported recently a drone strike in Idlib, Syria, against a senior member of al-Qaeda, rather than against a member of Daesh. The ostensible legal justification, the United States is even in Syria. Even more interestingly, CENTCOM claimed it immediately self-reported one civilian casualty that is investigating. But U.S. policymakers should not defer to the military's investigatory promises given its history of covering up or not sufficiently accounting for civilian casualties. In fact, the Associated Press has since reported that the strike wounded a family of six, including a 10-year-old child. With such over-the-horizon strikes likely to become a key component of Team Biden's rebranded counterterrorism strategy, the National Security Committees in Congress have a duty to comprehensively review and interrogate the strategic and human cost of this approach. This latest strike, rather than a one-off, appears to be a part of a pattern of drone attacks in Idlib, in spite of the administration's claimed moratorium on drone strikes during its counterterrorism review. In late September, military officials revealed it had carried out a drone strike in the province earlier that month against another alleged member of al-Qaeda while claiming no civilian casualties. It's no coincidence that CENTCOM appears to have proactively taken responsibility for this latest civilian casualty. This incident came at the end of a week of rightful public uproar after the New York Times revealed the U.S. military's apparent cover-up of an airstrike killing 80 civilians in eastern Syria in 2019. Rather than allowing more exhaustive investigative journalism to uncover its destructive and deadly actions in Syria, it appears CENTCOM is hoping that announcing an investigation will stave off an intense media frenzy like the one following its botched August 29th drone strike in Kabul during the withdrawal from Afghanistan that killed Zamari Ahmadi, a civilian electrical engineer, and his family. What's new about the recent Idlib strike is not that the United States is droning Syria and killing civilians without congressional authorization. It's that the U.S. military is now openly engaging a region of Syria, one that's the last stronghold of armed resistance to government that it had previously avoided outside of one-off strikes due to the risk of entanglement in the broader Syrian conflict. The quick succession of these strikes appears to be a quiet expansion of the U.S. forever wars and an apparent reflection of this president's desire to make U.S. endless wars primarily remote control moving forward. You'd be forgiven if you had forgotten that the United States is in Syria at all. There is no affirmative congressional authorization for U.S. military operations in Syria, despite the United States bombing the country and occupying portions of it since late 2014, after it became clear that
he could not get authorization for the use of military force against Daesh due to congressional opposition, then President Obama invoked the then 13-year-old 2001 AUMF pass to invade Afghanistan in 2001. As the U.S.-led airstrike campaign transitioned into a broader train, equip and occupy parts of eastern Syria, the United States continued drone strikes in the country without any domestic or international legal justification. The United States has been at war with a variety of adversaries in Syria. For years, endless war advocates have feared the expansion of the U.S. war in Syria to the rest of the country, particularly if war powers, champions in Congress did little to challenge multiple administrations' made-up legal concept of allied as associated forces in 2001 AUMF and dubiously broad collective self-defense doctrines. That's what we are seeing happen today, and yet another administration is one again risking sleepwalking into more endless war and the associated human cost. Congress shouldn't let them get away with it, and instead seize the opportunity to launch its own inquiry into U.S.-caused civilian harm in Syria, something Senator Elizabeth Warren, who is on the Senate Armed Services Committee, has already called for with regard to the 2019 Buzz strike cover-up exposed by the Times. That inquiry should not just be limited to one strike, however, but instead cover the entire U.S. air campaign in Syria following the rise of Daesh, and include all of uncounted who have yet to be officially acknowledged, let alone receive justice. Congress should make the U.S. military publicly refute credible evidence of hundreds of unclaimed civilian casualties caused by the United States and U.S. supported forces since the start of the war. It should review whether airstrikes there met the requirements of the laws of war, and if flattening residential areas was actually justified by the perceived threat or military objective. It should also seek to understand whether and with what frequency, if any, the United States has offered or given ex gratia or condolence payments to families it has harmed. The reality is that the United States military campaign in Syria, from arming the very armed groups it is ostensibly at war with, to its massive undercounting and denial of civilian casualties, has been a dismal display of illegality and failure.